Let's do a lot of things tonight. I got a lot of real potpourri of things tonight.
We started talking about the Celts again. But at the same time, we have been approaching England another direction as we link the teaching on the pyramids with Great Britain. The most obvious connection is the British inch. The British inch is a half a hair smaller, shorter, than the pyramid inch, which is the exact unit for measuring diameter of the earth from pole to pole. But I have nice people send me books. Here's from Harper and Row Publishers. I'm the vice president and publisher. He sent me a book. He said, while I'm quite aware that it reflects a perspective distinct from your own, not necessarily. I'm a truth searcher. He then says it does contain material related to my current teachings on things British, Egyptian, and geometrical. I'll leave it to you to sort out the wheat. Fascinating book. The New View Over Atlantis by John Michel. It is not as distinct a viewpoint as you might think. There are lots of distinct viewpoints that the fact that I am not a specialist, an avarice gobbler-upper of books with a simple philosophic frame of reference. Evolutionists start out with a hypothesis, never been proven. That hypothesis is that they can find connections that will evidence a progressive evolution to ever-advancing higher stages, that time works to produce advancement and advanced stages in both biological development, and some have taken it over into social and other areas. I start with a premise that if you take the Bible, you can just about sort out all real truth and leave the wheat behind. The philosophy of this book is the concept of lees. Now, the word lee in Webster's is a meadow, but in this case, it's a line between certain spots. I'm trying to find one picture that will say it all in just a sentence. Here it is, this astonishing picture from Bolivia, which will show up in many different books. I'll try to zero this one in crisp and sharp. Don't come close. I want them to get the full picture on the screen. To those listening on radio, it's a mountainous landscape in Bolivia, photographed from the air, but it displays an astonishing pattern of trackways in straight lines, regardless of obstacles, mountains, rocks, forests, an astonishing pattern of trackways and straight lines linking the sacred places of the Aymara Indians. You can see a center zone of the lines if we can pick it up and get the best part. That's about as good as you're going to get. See all those straight lines? Now, I don't know whether you want to call it science or art, or somewhere in between. Geomancy is that idea, I'm searching for words, that you can predict and determine things by lining things up on the earth. Now, here is a lee landscape from an estate in England. Now, probably it was a preacher in Scotland who started it all. The concept of the old straight tracks all across the English countryside. Now, it's harder to show this on radio, but just hang on for a minute. And it's amazing the way you will find, Bristol, England, more than any place I've ever been showed this, but it's amazing the way you'll find towns in England that are built along straight lines that feature the spire or tower of a church. I'm looking for some more pictures. I like to show you pictures. Here's some, it looks like a boundary of a township in these United States where things are laid out. Give me this full length here. Where things are laid out according to surveys. But that's not the case in England. You've got all these straight lines that just run. Sometimes they build highways and roads on them. They're just endless straight lines that go down the countryside in a close-up picture. But as you map it and track it, you will find that they line up religious sites. Now, here's alignments of old parish churches. Stay right where you're at with the camera. One directed towards Salisbury Cathedral, which is right out that direction. The other to the cathedral's former site at Old Salem. Cross at the well-marked Lee Center. The church, the Child, Oakford, and Dorset. Every one of the churches will lie on an absolute straight line. Same way this other straight line will connect all the religious spots. Just hang on a second. Got to find a better map to show you. Now here is a line of hilltop shrines dedicated to St. Michael or to other dragon-killing saints, which are pretty big, were pretty big in medieval England. St. Michael was a dragon killer, and St. George and St. Margaret. Now, a line that runs down the spine of southwest England to the island rock of St. Michael's Mount near the Land's End, Cornwall, gives indications of the spiritual significance in prehistoric times of these various centers, all of which are connected to local legends. Now, if I start counting them off, you'll see a circle up here to the right on a straight line. St. Michael's Church. Come right on down to number 2, Ogburn St. George's Church. To number 3, you have the Avebury Rings, and I haven't yet talked or taught about the Avebury Circle. Southern entrance. St. Michael's Tor, Glastonbury, is the next one, number 4. Number 5, St. Michael's Church. Number 6, St. Michael's the Monk, Earl Bridge. 7, Truel Church. 8, St. Michael's Church, Brinter. 9, the Hurler Stone Circles and Cheese Ring. And 10, St. Michael's Mount. Look at that line. Remember, these things go way back before we had surveying instruments. Most of the churches along this line are built on ancient, sacred shrines. Many of them hilltop shrines. Try to cool on some more. It's hot in here. You say, take your coat off. I wear a coat so I can keep it cool enough for everybody in here. Now, when the Westerners first went to China, they could not understand why that they weren't allowed to build in certain places. Yin and yang forces were at work, which go into the doctrine or philosophy or mystery of geomancy, the concept that magnetic forces, we would call them in the Western world, yin and yang, a male and female force, determine good spots and bad spots on the earth. Now, here's some lines in the Bolivian Andes, a different picture of them. You can just see the straight line heading out there for a certain ridge in those mountains. So what's it got to do with what you're teaching? Just stand still for a second. and show you some more spots. Here's alignments of megaliths in the northern part of Cornwall. Here's the Trigoseal stone circle. You draw straight lines through some of these circles, it'll go right through standing stone, right on. You just draw perfectly straight lines, they'll hit these spots. Here's another one, line of ancient sites through the Isle of Man. Pick each one of these holy shrines, circle them. They all fall on an exact straight line all down through the Isle of Man. Here's some more. Here's Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire border. See all the alignments of these churches, the way they all line up in straight lines. You know, once or twice would be impressive, but cities with holy shrines sort of center where the altar was, and these lines will project clear through the countryside for miles and miles. Now, the theory of this book is possibly beginning with ancient Atlantis. And hey, the relevance to what I'm teaching is, if I teach nothing else, if there's no prophetic plan in the pyramid at all, and I believe there is, and if the history and future of mankind before it became history were not encompassed in the diagrams of the pyramids, and if Stonehenge is but an accidental lineup with the pyramid of Giza, and if the Christ angle accidentally cuts through Bethlehem, and we have only the marvel of the construction of the pyramid and the strange fact that it lines up with those marker stones in Stonehenge, I'm still proving one point. Ancient man didn't evolve from a dumb savage to a higher state. We're a long ways below just trying to catch up to the knowledge that ancient man had. The Bible's rendition is man had a lot going for him and sunk his ship and has been trying to get back ever since. Evolution is no threat. I don't really care if they find a lot of evidence for evolution. Adam was created unique, and the descendants of Adam were ahead of where we are now. These people were smarter than we are. And we're pretty smart. I spent all afternoon reading a book that just fascinates the life out of me. The theory of this book is that some superior intellect knew where certain magnetic centers, life-regenerating, life-changing magnetic forces would operate. And some intellect of the past had this whole earth patterned out, probably starting with Atlantis, where those spots that became shrines, later degenerated by people in their memory traces who didn't really know their original purpose, and perhaps that purpose was totally changed in the reshaping of the earth after the flood and the removal of the firmament. But at some time in the distant past, some geniuses had a knowledge of the magnetic forces working on this earth and literally lined them up inside them in, and obviously an eclipse would affect the magnetic forces as other happenings in the heavens, which is why they were so fascinated with plotting eclipses and things of that nature, among other reasons. Now, this entire book, particularly when it gets down to Glastonbury and Stonehenge, as Glastonbury has been dug out of the trenches of tradition and restored in its historic valid position as the earliest church of Christendom. A more recent book has been done. I'm going to try to find the picture of it. I have a whole book and forgot to bring it tonight. To where the canals and fence lines and landscape is so arranged at Glastonbury that seen from aloft and photographed, it is nothing other than a replica of the whole zodiac on the ground. I'll show you a picture of the dog. I'll bring one of these nights. I have the book where she did it all. They just picked for this book that section of the Somerset marshes and the layouts of canals and landscape that was but a portrayal of the head of the dog. There it is. But the entire layout at Glastonbury is a replica on the ground when seen, and you black out the distractions, seen as a replica of the zodiac. Somebody way back there was awful smart. I mean, I'm telling you what the gestalt is I want for this. You spend all your life. I read this book through twice. I'm delighted he gave it to me. And I am convinced that there's something to these connecting lines, and it degenerated ultimately into a worship of the serpent power, which tells me that other truth, that the great serpent moves into the territory and preempts wherever he can, which is the gestalt I keep teaching of this warfare of the ages between God and Satan, and we're caught in between. The proof from America is equally amazing, because they laid out those lines here as well as in the southern area. But the second thought I'm making is the heart and the controlling center seem to be Britain. Britain. Some smart people. Now, we're pretty smart right now. I spent another part of the afternoon reading this staggering book, Black Holes, Walter Sullivan. Now, I started reading it because I'm still doing background work on those doggone people in Africa. And I pick up everything related to that before I get back to it. And those doggone people are going to lead us back to the pyramid, as Stonehenge led us to the pyramid. Am I boring you? This has nothing to say about the doggone people. Makes me wonder if Sullivan even knows about the doggoners. One of four tribes in Central Africa that worship a star you can't see that has a 50-year orbit. But he does talk about that star. To a remarkable extent, he said on page 29, studying the stars has told us things about nature that we could or might never have learned if we not looked beyond the earth. Newton's revolutionary discoveries regarding gravity were largely based, he said, what's it got to do with the Bible? Didn't the Bible say man started out smart and lived a long time, started to deteriorate, and God had to rescue him? Evolution doesn't make room for that. These facts suggest if man didn't start out smart, somebody else was here. And the Bible has this earth, by the way, occupied before Satan fell. Because Satan was in Eden while he was still the crowning cherub on the mountain of God. To a remarkable extent, studying the stars has told us things about nature that we could or might never have learned had we not looked beyond the earth. Newton's revolutionary discoveries regarding gravity were largely based on observations that describe the movements of the moon and planets. Lockyer did not discover helium in the laboratory, but in terms of its characteristic wavelengths in sunlight. He called it helium from the Greek for sun. And the same is true of the finding that matter can be compressed to almost unbelievable densities. Listen to this date now. An early clue came in 1844 when Friedrich W. Bessel at the observatory at Königsberg in Prussia, now Kaliningrad in the Soviet Union, observed that Sirius, or Sirius, or Sirius, the brightest of all stars, Sirius, does not move among the other stars in a straight line, but in a slightly irregular manner. We think of the stars as being fixed relative to one another. The Big Dipper or the constellation Orion seem to come from year to year, but the stars are actually in motion in respect to one another. Over the years and centuries, the observed positions of the brightest change slightly. The fact that the motion of Sirius was along a wavy rather than a straight line suggested to Bessel that the star had an invisible companion. This is 1844. It was already well known to astronomers that the Earth in its annual flight around the Sun does not move in a smooth ellipse. All orbiting bodies, as Kepler discovered almost four centuries ago, move along elliptical rather than circular paths. Rather, there's a slight waviness to its movement. The Earth, that is, because of the influence of the moon. You got something in your mouth. You either get it out or swallow it. I like to look at things before I swallow them. Well, it is the gravity of the Earth that holds the moon in orbit. The gravity of the moon as it orbits, the Earth, my science memory tells me, has got about 8 times the gravity of the moon, and then there's a Doppler effect as distance is involved. While it's the gravity of the Earth that holds the moon in orbit, the gravity of the moon as it orbits is sufficient to pull the Earth to one side or another of the Earth's own path around the Sun. When the moon is on the side of the Earth opposite the Sun, full moon, it pulls the Earth away from the Sun. At new moon, 2 weeks later, the moon pulls the Earth toward the Sun. The effect through each year is that the Earth weaves in and out of the path that it would fly were the moon not there. If a distant astronomer could see the Earth, but not the moon, he could still infer the moon's presence from this wobbly orbit. So was it with Bessel. Astronomers, through their study and classification of stars in terms of those that, for example, are larger or smaller, brighter or dimmer, redder or bluer than the Sun, had been able to calculate the mass of Sirius rather accurately. The term mass refers to the amount of material in an object, be it anything from a tiny electron to a star like the Sun. The amount of material in an object. It is more universally applicable than weight, because weight is defined by the response of an object to gravity. Gravity varies from place to place. For example, it's a tiny bit stronger in Minneapolis than it is in Chicago. So, ladies, you want to weigh in Chicago, not Minneapolis. Go see a diet doctor in Chicago. Whereas the mass of an object, measured by its inertia, which is resistance to acceleration, try to pick something up or move it, or throw it out there, the resistance to acceleration is the measurement of mass. It's everywhere the same, be it on Earth or far out in space. And the mass of a star is usually defined relative to the Sun. The mass of Sirius is 2.28 solar masses, so it's twice and a quarter the mass of the Sun. That's pretty big. And pretty massy. From the wavy motion of Sirius, it was possible to determine the time it took its unseen companion to complete one orbit around the star. It's 1844. science up there, starting to figure this out. And from the extent to which Sirius, a gigantic star, was being 2.25 times the sun in mass, was being pulled off its path, it was possible to estimate the mass of the companion. The companion star was roughly equal to that of the sun in mass. Yet even though it was one of the nearest stars to Earth, it wasn't visible to Bessel. It wasn't visible to the naked eye when Sirius, one of the brightest stars in the heavens, and it couldn't see this one. 19 years after Bessel made his observation, Alvin Clark of the famous American telescope-making family found the companion while trying out an 18-inch lens that was to be installed in the Northwestern University's Dearborn Observatory in Illinois. This companion star to Sirius was extremely dim. When viewed from the same distance as the sun is from the Earth, it would only be 1/400th as bright as the sun. Among typical stars, the small, dim ones burn at lower temperature and are redder. The big, hot ones burn white, but this one was white, considerably whiter than the sun. Why then was it so dim? The only explanation that astronomers could think of was that its surface area was very small. Yet to exert its observed influence on Sirius, it must be extremely massive, therefore very dense. As material equal in mass to that of the sun must be squeezed into an area no larger than a planet, or in terms of more down-to-earth equivalents, the material of a large stone compressed to a grain of sand. Squeezed down. Now, as Sir Arthur Eddington put it in 1927, the message of the companion of Sirius when it was decoded ran, "I am composed of material." This is the invisible companion decoded. "I am composed of material 3,000 times denser than anything you have come across. A ton of my material would be a little nugget you could put into a matchbox. And that'd weigh a ton." What reply can one make to such a message? The reply which most of us made in 1914. "Shut up, don't talk nonsense." While it seemed nonsense in 1914, 2 centuries earlier, Sir Isaac Newton had guessed this. I'll skip over that. Likewise, Joseph Priestley. With the advent of modern concepts of atomic structure, Newton's ideas in this regard had largely been forgotten, so the discovery of the companion of Sirius, the first white dwarf, came as a deep shock. With only one known, the evidence was not convincing, but soon more were found. They are, in fact, common, but being dim, only the nearest can be seen. Now, here is probably the best picture I've seen of what happens to a white dwarf. If on Earth, now, if on Earth you were to stand on a scale and weigh 80 kilos, 1 kilo weight sitting to the side, to escape gravity it would take a velocity of 11 kilometers per second to shoot a rocket off. Assuming the Earth's 6,000 kilometers radius. Just assume that for a moment. Now, put that in some kind of compressing machine. Now, our concept of the atom eventually taught modern science, and it's hard for me to visualize this, but I can see it. I'm talking about the fact we're pretty smart. Modern man's pretty smart. He discovered that what looks like matter is mostly space. In fact, whatever matter is, we could probably put it in a shoebox, because most of everything is space. And atoms break down into protons and neutrons and electrons, giving out a negative charge. And if you can smash these together and condense the space and tighten whatever the solid parts of matter are into compaction, you reduce the circumference of their activity. So let's compress this same Earth from 6,000 kilometers radius down to 1,500. That means we've turned a tennis ball into a golf ball. Now the same guy standing on the scales, you see he's sort of dragging at the rear end now. He's got a droopy bottom. His gravity's pulling him down. He now weighs 1.5 tons. That same kilo is now 16 kilos. You haven't moved anything, just compressed the Earth he's on. Taken the space out, moved it down into a denser matter. To escape, the speed you need to escape is 180 kilometers per second, whereas 11 of them would have done it on that 6,000 kilometer radius. Now, a kilometer is about a half mile, give or take a little. So if you've got a 3,000 mile radius condensed down to a 750 mile radius, you suddenly have, same man's become 1.5 tons. Now we see this on the moon. Obviously the spacemen were much lighter up there in terms of weight. They could jump around and didn't take as much velocity to get loose, didn't take as much rocket thrust to come off of the moon as it did to leave the Earth, because the mass is less. Now take this same Earth and compress it again till it's only 100 kilometers radius. Now you turn it into a pea, from a tennis ball to a golf ball to a pea, or maybe a pinhead. Now this poor old guy really needs a diet. Same guy on the same scale weighs 218 tons. He's gone from 80 kilos to 218 tons. That same kilo is now 2,500 kilos. And to get loose, you'd have to have a force that would send you 28,000 kilometers per second. I mean, the rapture would really have to rev you up. Now you compress this thing down to a microscopic size by comparison to 2 kilometers radius. Poor old guy's a pancake. He weighed 1,395,000 tons. That's enough to give you a headache. And his 1 kilo now weighs 16 million kilos. And to escape, it takes 180 million kilometers per second. Now, we're smart enough to figure that out, and that's what a white dwarf is. So compressed, so small. Now those Dogon Indians, or Dogon natives, not Indians, in Central Africa, have known that for thousands of years. They knew this little star that you can't see went around Sirius. Now it's called Sirius B. They knew it took a 50-year elliptical orbit with Sirius A, one of the foci. They named it after the smallest grain that they knew. They knew it was the heaviest star. Now that's a mystery, how they knew it. We started discovering white dwarfs after the 1844, another 20 years. It's seen finally 1863. Then about 1920, just before we're going in, about just before I was born, people figured out white dwarfs exist. Now even more astounding is the absolute, total much more evidence than that for evolution is the existence of antimatter. Now, electrons and protons and atoms, they're invisible. But they build up to visible things. You can't see with the naked eye because it's the small electrons. I've come to know from scientific study that my tennis shoes are space. And I'm space. A lot of stuff moving in me. We're smart enough. Modern man figured that out. Modern man has now figured out that there's antimatter. They've even given names to them. That as there exists electrons, protons, neutrons, there's the opposite in the invisible sphere. And when they meet, annihilation occurs and energy results. I can't find them. You know, there's science fiction things on TV that are solidly based in modern science. There's one not too long ago I saw on TV. One of these, this British competition to Star Trek that has the guy that used to play the one who wore the disguises in Mission Impossible when it was not a bad show. Whatever his name is. He's got this funny woman with him that can blink her eyes and become everything from a skunk to a sparrow. We had one of those where people that were antimatter, ethereal, were trying to change places to keep the balance in the universe with somebody that was matter. And whereas man in that story was evolving, antimatter was devolving. So if you could change places, you'd go the other direction after thousands of years of coming the other way. You know, it's a tragedy that most people who saw it did not know that there was a substance of science that somebody done. I like to see anything on TV that shows a little thought behind it. It's very rare. We're pretty smart. We discovered antimatter, which I may get on when I talk about demonology. You see, science is going to prove the Bible was right. We're all pretty smart. Now, the latest fad is, particularly since they sent up those satellites that take X-ray pictures, is black holes. Now, black holes, pulsars and quasars and all that stuff. Let me skip over that. These black holes, that's why I was reading this book. A black hole is, oh, I got a ring in here. I wish I could do something with this stupid microphone. A black hole is the next step of a white dwarf. Why have I got a ring? Am I going to have to quit this because of the speakers? You keep compressing. Black holes postulate the theory that this compression keeps going until it reaches an infinite stage where the gravitational effects are so strong because of the buildup of mass that even light is captured by gravity. So you can't see them because there's no light. Now, Einstein proved that light is bent by space and space by gravity. And one of the great experiments around the time of the war was a lucky eclipse of the sun that occurred, so that Einstein's theory could be checked. Because he postulated, you shoot a light on a rocket that's going a certain stage through lights, and the rocket is accelerating, you shoot the light here, it's going to be like you throw a ball, gravity will pull it to the I throw this over there, gravity pulls it down. But if we were accelerating at a certain speed where we had bypassed gravity, you also reach a point where the floor came up and hit it. Well, Einstein proved that light's affected by gravity. Light has a speed. And mass reaches a stage, as we just saw, that you need speed, acceleration, to pull away from it. Took 11 kilometers a second to get off of that 6,000 kilometer diameter Earth. Took a great deal more in the diagrams we just showed you to get away from one that's certain mass. You're going to reach a certain mass stage where the speed of light will not be fast enough to get loose from the grip. You got a black hole. Now, the next one you're just going to... I haven't got time tonight to do it. These were the special theories that went beyond Einstein's theory of relativity. Time also. And again, some of these more recent spin-offs of third-dimensional Twilight Zone type things that have grown into fancy movies, there's some solid bases there. Because, in essence, the twin theory of Einstein postulated that if one twin took off at the right speed in space travel, when he came back, he would have aged about 20 minutes, and his twin brother would have aged many years, because time is also relative. And the black hole concept postulates a point where time and space and light all merge into one, and time stands still. Talk about a bottomless pit. Now, you know, any one of these, we could stay on this for another 10 years, any one of these subjects. You know, you follow it yourself. I recommend this book by Walter Sullivan as one of the best studies ever to come out on this subject. And he's gone beyond black holes to that chapter he calls the demon bird of Satan, the real black hole, Sig X1, off the edge of the Milky Way. Now, the whole point of everything I'm saying is we just, as the discovery of the first white dwarf led to others, the first collapsing black holes, for example, if they exist, would pass right through this Earth. It's just like an electron can go through something else. Now, what started all this was that strange phenomenon in northern Siberia.
This is the end of Side 1.